It's the SkyTrain Fairness edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Europe rejects God, childish church sports, Vatican narrows its own opinion, and the fair gates on SkyTrain. Let's begin episode 166.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan, guess what?
What?
Norway is de-Christianizing itself. It is becoming an apostate nation, sort of.
Oh, wow, excellent.
Yes. Apparently, Christianity will no longer be the official religion of Norway. Norway has distanced itself from its Christian past. The Storting, the country's parliament, why can't they just call it a parliament? This is foreigners. Will be amending its constitution so the state no longer has an official religion, ending a 1,000-year tradition of the Church of Norway. A parliamentary committee presented a report on Tuesday which contains a unanimous recommendation to have the state permanently separate itself from the church. All 169 members of the seven parties in the parliament, including the 10 representatives from the Christian Democratic Party and 30 from the Conservative Party, so, you know, the people you traditionally think would be against this, are said to be behind this particular move. The government will no longer have a minister of churches, and the state will no longer be responsible for the appointment of bishops and deans. Instead, Norway will treat all religions and philosophies equal. I like that aspect of philosophies and religion. The state will no longer engage in religious activities, but support the Norwegian church, national church, and other religious belief communities in line with it. So essentially, there is a big thing in Europe, in Norway. They have the Church of Norway, mm-hmm. which is a Christian church, but not any other weird church. It's basically a variation of Lutheranism, sort of evangelical type. And apparently about 86% of the people in Norway are baptized as that. But it's one of those weird things where, you know, it's kind of become a social tradition as opposed to an actual religion in the sense that we think about it. So this amendment, which is designed to change the constitution, is supposed to happen on Monday, which is a good thing. And I think it's quite remarkable considering the recent past in Norway with the horrible terrorist attack by the Christian fundamentalist, what's his name again?
Reykjavik or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Who cares what his name is?
But no, I thought this was it was a good news. It's there should be a separation of church and state. And I mean, it's ironic because again, we hear study after study that even though people belong to the church, they're not actually religious. I mean, the relevance of atheism in the Scandinavian countries is one of the highest in the world, but they still sort of belong to this sort of archaic past. And in doing so, like, we kind of kicked on Sam Harris last week, and I admit, you know, we can vilify the person, but some of the ideas that people can come up with, even if they don't have all good ideas, are important. And one of the things he mentions is the idea that moderates create sort of a space where radicals can exist. So if you have a country that believes in God, even officially, even if most people don't really believe in it, but you create this area where, well, it's my religious beliefs and I'm allowed to have my religious beliefs, it provides that breathing room for radicals and the crazies to build up to when they actually do pop. Whereas if someone had said this about almost anything else, someone might have said, hey, wait a minute, that guy seems to be kind of crazy long before. But if you guise it in religion, it tends to go away with that.
But it also reflects, I think, the interesting historic background that some of the Northern European countries have with religion. I mean, part of why Norway would have the Church of Norway being more sort of Lutheran descent dates all the way back to the sort of civil war that erupted in Christianity around the time of Martin Luther. So them having their own non-Catholic church was a really early display of secularism. And now they've gone that extra step and say, okay, we don't actually need to have this kind of placeholder for religion when we know that our civilization, our country doesn't even really need that level of belief. So it's a nice way to see, you know, countries become less religious.
Well, and on that one note, just to add a little briefness in there, it also shows in some ways those people who claim that religion is really just a mechanism for authoritarian control. It's one way for the elites of a country to maintain control over the masses. And that was one of the odd things that came out of the Protestant Revolution. Again, Norway is a great example. Most of the Scandinavian churches is where the local princes and kings wanted to maintain control over their people. So they literally expropriated the Catholic Church system mm-hmm. for their own particular means.
Well, yeah, it was kind of, we can go on this all day, but I mean, like, it was very interesting because you had kind of a Christian empire based in Rome, which is historically not a bad place to base your empire.
No.
And you had this kind of imperial revolt with not just the Protestant Reformation, but the following schisms that went with it, you know, the English Reformation. And a lot of these nations decided that they wanted to invest their power in their own kings and princes, which is not great for the little people, but it's good for them in a sort of big historic picture that they're breaking from this foreign control that, you know, doesn't really have any understanding of how their society is different, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, an interesting, you know, development right now. But speaking of, you know, countries in Europe and religion, did you know that the least religious country on Earth is East Germany, which is ironic because East Germany hasn't existed for about 30 years.
But what? Is this one of those neutrino things that they were talking about, you know, how they're traveling faster and light, so they've somehow gone back in time and East Germany has reappeared?
I think it has something to do with the Large Hadron Collider or something. Anyway, actually, this is a new study by University of Chicago sociologist Tom Smith. Great name, by the way, has provided evidence that East Germans appear to be the most unbelieving people around. And what he's done here is he's looked at survey data on belief in God in 30 countries between 1991 and 2008. Unfortunately, Canada was not on that list, so we can't gauge ourselves too much. But the citizens of the former German Democratic Republic were when this study was first done. So we have records for that area of the world. And it turns out people who used to live in that part of Germany have the highest rate of atheism at 52.1%.
Wow.
Yeah. Coming in second is the Czech Republic. It is the most atheist country in existence. They have 39.9%. Followed by the French at 23.3, the Dutch at 19.7, and the Swedes at 19.3. And Japan is the country with the lowest percentage of people who say, quote, no God really exists and have no doubts about it at 4.3. So they're the lowest amount of people who are, ooh, I'm really sure.
Right. So there's a lot of agnosticism, perhaps, you know, that isn't measured by this particular number. But atheism, really, the Japanese? I was just reading the other day about how the Philippines apparently is the most Christian-believing country in the world.
Mm. And that, in fact, the Philippines, according to this study, is the most religious, with 83.6% people who are sure God exists, and only 0.7% are atheists. Of course, the United States, very godly as well, only 3% rate of atheism, and a 60.6% percentage are sure that God exists.
I saw Pew reported had that number larger, at least in the United States.
Well, see, that's the interesting thing about this study is the sociologist in question, he didn't actually conduct any of these surveys. He just compiled the data. And what it was, the study itself, is based on the International Social Survey Program, the ISSP, say that three times fast, which asked three questions. Do you believe in God? And then ranked your answer on a 6-point scale. And then they asked, has your belief in God changed over your life? And then finally, a agree or disagree question about a personal God who cares about human life. And the ISSP, they covered 18 countries in 1991, counting East and West Germany, Northern Ireland, Great Britain separately. Then they did 33 in 98, 42 in 2008. So he compiled the data that, you know, made sense given what he had, right? So it's not like the Pew Forum where they're doing new studies. He's kind of, this is a bit of a
meta study.
Yeah, but it's still, I think, kind of valuable in some respects. What's interesting, I think, is how this data kind of contradicts a few things that we've previously thought. And, I mean, the whole thing with Norway, of course, many of us assumed that the Scandinavian countries were the most atheist countries.
I just said that.
Yeah. But it turns out that, like, Sweden is ranked fifth, which is, I mean, fifth is still good.
Right.
They don't get a medal, but they're, you know, they're respectable.
Right.
Right.
They don't get a cross either.
No, they don't. Okay. They don't get anything. but another question is, why is or was Eastern Germany so atheist?
Can I guess? You're going to probably tell me I'm wrong, but I'm going to guess.
You can guess.
I suspect that with lacking sort of the institutional infrastructure for religion in East Germany and most of the communist countries, not all of them, but most of them, mm-hmm. that this sort of denied the churchers the ability to sort of have this innate ability to recruit people from birth. I mean, we often have talked about you get a child by the age of five, you have them for life, and that most children tend to be the same religion as their parents, so if their parents kind of grow up in an atheist society, they're likely to continue that onward. I'm off the mark.
No, actually, I think that's pretty close. I looked at a few other articles about this particular survey, and basically one of the big answers is, of course, the fact that, you know, Eastern Germany went through the influence of National Socialism and then communism, and for about 60 years or so, religion was really on the back burner. But researchers are also suggesting that one of their influences is the fact that many of the Slavic and non-Orthodox communities in that area, since the Middle Ages, were very non-religious to begin with. And, I mean, that 60 years may seem like a long time from our point of view, but historically speaking, it's a pretty short amount of time. So the secularization of that area is a lot more culturally ingrained in them than, say, Americans or British or Italians, right? And they even mentioned that particularly it seemed very strong in places like Thuringia and Saxony. And even the resistance to, like, the communists and that sort of thing wasn't always religiously motivated. So it wasn't like they were saying, you know, we want to be Catholic, damn it. They had other reasons for resisting, and it wasn't necessarily that the religion was being suppressed. It was that they just didn't care in the beginning about religion.
One of the things I wonder that plays into this, and this goes with one of the memes I mentioned before, is the idea of control and authoritarian control. We're going to contrast this with the Philippines, right? Now, the Philippines has been a colony for hundreds of years, right? The Spanish first made it a colony, I think, in the 1600s, maybe
well,
earlier
the
than
Dutch
that.
The Dutch as well, and they were kind of fighting over it. I mean, it was a contested area.
Exactly. So you have sort of a repressed people that have been overlorded by one country or another for generations, and the overlords would, of course, use whatever structures are available to keep the people in place, mm-hmm. religion being one of them. Whereas in Eastern Europe, in Scandinavia, and most of the European countries, although you've had a lot of things like poverty, which is sort of equivalent, there hasn't been this sense of colonialism that has affected them, with possible exception of the Russian overtaking of a lot of their societies. But I wonder if that has a bit to play with it, is that the power structures have so reinforced it in, like, the Philippines for centuries that it has such a strong root, whereas it never really did have that strong root beforehand. Because, I mean, remember, Christianity coming to Northern Europe would have been, what, maybe 1,000 years for there, right? Because, I mean, you know.
Well, I mean, and it was an ongoing struggle. I mean, if you look at the history of that part of Europe, I mean, it was kind of, you know, it was sort of an unknown frontier for a large part of history. I mean, even relatively recently speaking, it was underpopulated, very decentralized. A lot of the communities were very far apart. They didn't have a lot of communication with each other. So that would have made a big impact. And when you mention a place like the Philippines, you know, it's much more, what's the word, more people per capita, right?
Increased density.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's that I don't know if you call it maybe the melting pot, but I mean, it just sort of seems like that's a place where religion will flourish, because you're constantly being pushed shoulder to shoulder with somebody who might be religious. And, you know, there's Christians there, there's Muslims there, there's different religious backgrounds that are there that are all sort of fighting to have control. In fact, I even read this article today that Lady Gaga had to cancel a live show there because some fundamentalist religious people thought that her dance moves were too suggestive.
Well, she does have the habit of wearing meat, and that may offend some vegetarians like the Buddhist. I'm sure that was probably sure it was
yeah,
a Buddhist.
Yeah, I bet you it was the Buddhist.
But no, you are right, because the Philippines also is in a relatively constant state, at least for the last while, of revolt, because a number of the islands are controlled by either a very particular ethnic group, or again, there's a strong Muslim versus Christian fight there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly, right? It's keeping in mind the difference of, you know, the cultural background, the historic background, and then when you add in religion to that mix, you kind of stir the pot a bit more. So, but nevertheless, very interesting study from the University of Chicago. We'll have to keep our eyes on this, see where it develops. In the meantime, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back after this.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR, of course.
You know, we were just talking about sort of a win against religion. And just so that we can emphasize this point, it seems like religion is kicking itself again. I'm going to talk about the Vatican bubble. Members of the Vatican's bioethic advisory panel have called for its board to resign after scientists who don't support the core church teachings on issues like birth control and infertility, which were featured in a conference recently. The Pontifical Academy of Life's February 4th conference on diagnosing and treating infertility was a, quote, Planned Parenthood-like meeting that caused great scandal with church elders and Catholic fundamentalists. Essentially, they had this big meeting, and they invited some people who sort of disagreed with their point of view, and it has caused a bit of a stir.
There was much monocle dropping into champagne glasses.
I think it would be more, well, I was going to say habit dropping, but what do the pointy hats bishops wear? It's,
they have a name?
It's a funny name, too.
Oh, okay.
They were upset because it was a Vatican meeting open to the public, yet, quote, consisted of promoting uncritically what the church teaches to be intrinsically bad. Just for a bit of a background, the Pontifical Academy for Life is a pontifical academy of the Roman Catholic Church. They have several of them. And it's dedicated to promoting the church's consistent life ethics. It also does related research into bioethics and Catholic moral theology. It was founded in 1994. The academy is dedicated to the study of information and the formation of principles, problems of biomedicine and the law relative to the promotion and defense of life. Above all, in the direct relation that they have with the Christian morality and the directives of the church magisterium. I hate that word, magisterium. I guess it does sound kind of cool. But
yeah, sure.
In the past, the Academy invited only like-minded professionals to speak at its conference to ensure a consistency in moral views. The participants were expected to provide scientific advice, but advice faithful to the Catholic doctrine. So they wanted to hear people's opinions, but only opinions that conformed with their own, which leads to a certain contradiction. But
sounds like a Bigfoot convention.
Yes. However, the Academy's new president seems to be a little too enlightened. he decided to be a bit more open with the advice the Academy was receiving by inviting people who did not necessarily share the church's view on conception, the nature of death, and that sort of thing. At the February conference, five of the seven presentations dealt with the pill, artificial insemination, and in vitro fertilization from a purely neutral standpoint, neglecting any moral reference. So essentially, they gave their talk about the scientific aspects of this without judging one way or the other as to whether this is a good or bad thing, but these are sort of the facts on the ground. And of course, as one might expect, this enraged some of the Academy's members. The rector of the Academy of Philosophy in Liechtenstein wrote that the Academy was, quote, losing its full and pure commitment to the truth and its enthusiastic service to the unreduced magnificent church's teaching on human life in its whole splendor. Essentially, they were going off message, and how dare you do that, you bastards.
Mm-hmm.
He also continued to say that this is a great evil for the public congress sponsored by the Academy because a neutral scientific description of methods of infertility treatment has absolutely no place in the Academy, which was explicitly founded to deal with these matters in the light of anthropological, theological, and moral truth. Now, this is one of those times when the definition of truth is a little untruthy.
Yes.
You know, it's funny, you know, we want to talk about these scientific issues, but we don't want to know any of the science about it because, well, that might go against our preconceived conceptions. The Academy's coordinating secretary, on a good point, has rejected this criticism by saying that the Academy was a scientific research institution open to dialogue with the scientific world. Again, that sounds like kind of a good thing, and it's a shame they're being vilified for doing what any institution should be trying to promote.
Mm-hmm.
However, this, of course, may not be about this one particular institution in and of itself. This may reflect a growing dispute within the Catholic hierarchy as Pope Benedict pushes back against some of the, quote, modernizing reforms of Pope John Paul II. And he's attempting to essentially return the church and all its institutions, so things like religious orders, hospitals, and academies, to a more traditional Catholic identity. Just to get you an idea of how this may have actually affected things, in March, the Academy hastily canceled a stem cell research conference because one of its speakers included a scientist who worked with embryonic stem cells, and that, of course, goes against the church's teachings. What can you say? It's like, you know, they get close to doing a good thing. So they've, you know, they set up this Academy. They're actually getting scientific evidence. They still may go in the wrong direction, but at least they'll be dealing with real, honest facts. But no, that may be risky because knowledge to any religion seems to be a very dangerous thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it does segue nicely into our next little bit of skeptical news here, because we have justly criticized Catholicism for some rather shocking, illegal, or suspicious behavior. But I honestly think this is the first time we're going to criticize them for being bad sportsmen. And that's because you would never expect baseball to be high on their list of things to rage about. But that is exactly what they're raging about right now. So this amazing story comes out of Phoenix, where a young second base player has apparently stirred up controversy by having the audacity to be female. That's right. Paige Sluchbach, who plays second base for the Mesa Preparatory Academy, a high school in Phoenix, was preparing for the big game, the championship Arizona Charter Athletic Association State Championship at Phoenix College. However, her chance never came, as Mesa's Preparatory Academy's opponent for the championship game, the aptly named Our Lady of Sorrows, forfeited the game. And now you might ask, well, why on earth would they do this? Well, Our Lady of Sorrows is run by the U.S. branch of the Society of St. Pius X, a group of conservative traditionalist priests who disagree with the reforms of Vatican II Council in the 1960s and broke with the Catholic Church in the 80s. They take a hard-line conservative opinion on most issues, including girls playing sports. So earlier in the season, Our Lady of Sorrows played Mesa Prep and lost both times. During those games, Paige voluntarily sat out. She sat out as a, out of respect for Lady of Sorrow's beliefs. And, you know, I think that's very humble of her to do that, considering she was under no obligation to do so. But she wasn't going to sit out of the championship game, and everyone except Lady of Sorrows seems to acknowledge that was very fair.
Well, and from what I was understanding in my reading, is it wasn't even so much that she insisted on playing. It's her teammate said, listen, you're a member of our team, you're an important member of our team. So this is a lot of strong support from her own school, from her own teammates.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's not like this is some wild feminist trying to promote some sort of an agenda. This is a genuine sort of grassroots entity. And this goes into this this particular school is what we were just talking about, how there's sort of this movement in some ways to reemphasize traditional or fundamentalist Catholic beliefs in the system.
Mm-hmm. And the school in question, Soros has declined to comment on the situation. They did issue a written statement saying their decision to back out of the game was consistent with their policy of co-ed sports. And I found this quotation. Our school aims to instill in our boys a profound respect for women and girls. Teaching our boys to treat ladies with deference, we choose not to place them in an athletic competition where proper boundaries can only be respected with difficulties. So as we all know, the proper way to treat girls is to treat them like delicate flowers.
Well, and I'm also wondering, I mean, what exactly do they think is going to happen on a baseball field? I mean, if it was football, I mean, I still think you're pushing it here. But at football, you could say, well, maybe they would have inappropriate contact with it. But, I mean, we're talking baseball here. What position does he play? Does it mention that?
Second base.
Second base. So, I mean, what? Someone's going to slide into second base from the other team, and lo and behold, she's going to be pregnant. I mean, is that what they really think is going to happen?
They might be thinking that. I don't know.
You know, and of course, this so goes against them. Because, I mean, one of the things that I was talking about before the show with one of the people in the studio was the whole idea about how pedophilia and how, you know, homosexuality is rife within the Catholic Church. And you wonder why they get these sort of weird views about sex and women and all that, and why there may seem to be, oh my God, no pun intended, I shouldn't touch women. Well, this sort of reinforces that whole ostracization, and it just sends the wrong message on so many levels.
Well, it's that weird thing. They're okay with these boys in a locker room, getting changed, taking showers together, but, oh, a girl, she may have cooties. Like, oh my goodness, right? And a lot of people have commented on this ridiculous story. Lisa Matz, who's the director of public policy at the American Association of University Women, said the situation is a clear example of why they need enforced rules about equal gender participation in sports. Nancy Hogshead-Maker, senior director for the Advocacy of Women's Sports Foundation, said that the school's decision to forfeit doesn't aid its own students. It puts them in a position where they're going to grow up thinking this is the right way to deal with women, and how is that going to affect them in the workforce and their lives if they ever get married? Like, how is that going to impact them?
Well, and also, what does it also teach them? I mean, first of all, there are the members of the team who said, you know, we're going to get them this time. We're going to win the championship. And I should point out, too, that this is actually charter school. So this is not your regular state schools. And one of the reasons why that they can sort of sidestep some of the normal constitutional rights that you would get in a state school is because they are a charter and they're a private school, mm-hmm. which is one of the reasons why I'm not a big fan of charter schools in the world, and why we have often heard on our own show and among others about the double issue of religious charter schools.
Yeah.
But think about it. In a way, this is also teaching them a bad sportsmanship, because if you come up against something and you don't want to have to deal with it, you just quit and give up. You don't actually try and deal with it. You don't try and fight the fight or try and win the battle. I mean, how much more of a moral argument would they have said if they had played the team with the girl on the team and they had won, and in their own minds they could say, see, God was on our side or what have you, right? But no, what they've learned is that whenever you reach a difficult point in your life, run away.
Yeah, literally take your ball and go home.
Yes.
And the other really damaging aspect of this is the fact that they're trying to spin this like, oh, we respect women so much, we're not going to play sports with them. Well, that's not what they're saying. They're saying women are so impure, so dirty, so we can't
risk. So contagious.
So contagious that our players may turn into, you know, gay,
straight marriage, people,
liberal, you know, losers or something. I like it's so ridiculous. And oh goodness, I mean, when we talk about all the reasons to be mad at sort of fundamental religion, their opposition to girls playing baseball was not high on that list, but now it is.
It seems so petty.
It does. Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll return after this. Stay tuned.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, let's discuss
something.
Translinking?
Yeah, something. The fairness of SkyTrain. Ooh, double entendre.
That's
is it a double entendre?
No, I don't think so.
It has to be sexual in nature. Yeah, pun. That's the word.
Yeah.
So we're going to sort of talk about SkyTrain, you know, social service versus freeloader heaven. Okay, I should explain why I thought this was a topic for our show. I have been having an on-again, off-again discussion/debate with a number of my friends about the way I feel vilified by TransLink. Most of these discussions have been heated, but hollow. By hollow, I mean relying on sort of anecdotal evidence, vague impressions, you know, about authority and the absence of, well, really the absence of any hard information. So I thought I would attempt to rectify my ignorance, and I suspect a number of our listeners' ignorance, about this issue by just seeing what is going on with TransLink and the so-called fair thievery.
Well, just so listeners who don't know, TransLink is the sort of overruling organization in Vancouver that controls all of our transit. It's, I guess, sort of, what would you call it? Like, part Crown Corporation, part private industry?
Well, it's one of those weird things, and I didn't want to go down this track because this is another rant I can do, but I'll try and keep this brief. This is one of those private-public sort of partnerships. So the buses and all that are, I believe, sort of rented or owned, semi-owned, by the city, the GVRD. But the management of it is a private corporation, the Mountain Transit. I can't remember, the West Coast Transit Mountain Authority or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, but it's governed by a board of governors, which are public employees. Some of them are mayors, some of them are elected. So it's kind of this sort of weird mishmash of private and public entities, which adds, I think, to a lot of the unclearness as to where money goes and how it goes, because it's a public operated system, but it's kind of privately owned or some variation of that.
I mean, the reason I mention it is because a lot of cities don't have that system. Like I know, like Los Angeles, for example, has competing bus companies that have different routes, rates, all that kind of stuff as well. So Vancouver's a bit unique in that respect.
Well, but unique in the world, but not unique in Canada. I think almost every mass transit system in Canada is actually publicly owned, with some exceptions where you got this sort of private public partnership. Mm-hmm. And to add to your explanation for those people who are not in the GVRD, which is the sort of lower mainland of Vancouver, Greater Vancouver Regional District.
Sure.
And the idea of SkyTrain, for those who don't know, it's essentially our subway. Some of the subways are above ground, some are the below ground. Because they're above ground, we called them the SkyTrain. It was a big expo thing back when you guys had expo. I wasn't in Vancouver at that time. But like I say, what I'm going to sort of deal around here is the whole idea of fair theft. And yes, there's a double meaning in that one as well. There's been a lot of changes to our regional mass transit system. Due, of course, to some criminal instances on SkyTrain, there was the introduction of the transit police, complete with handguns. And this was done, I think, about 5 or 6 years ago. I think 2005 or thereabouts is when it came in.
Yep.
This was ostensibly to make the transit system safer for passengers. because there would be a dedicated security force to protect the ridership. Now, it is true there have been some horrific crimes in the past, but in 2009, they responded to about 28,000 incidences, which is, I mean, quite a lot. However, if you factor in that 25,000 of those 28 instances are crimes were actually fare evasion, it seems, well, I mean, really? They spend most of their time checking tickets. Of all the other other crimes, less than half of them, granted a noteworthy number of them, were for violent crimes, although most of these were theft. The Transit Police came under fire this year after it was revealed that they were expected to issue at least 8 violation tickets per shift as part of their reasonable performance measure. Now, of course, the transit system itself accounts for anywhere from about 20 to 40 million, depending on the accountant that you use. So let's assume the lower number of about 21 million, which is the most consistent I found. And let's assume each one of them catches their quota of 8, and that in turn discourages, let's say, 10 times that number, just to do a fudge factor there. So there are 161 officers. So you do the math, carry the one, yada, yada. So they recoup, or save, depending on how you have this, for TransLink, less than about $50,000 a month, plus or minus a bit, depending on how their shifts work out. So let's take the shifts into account. So let's add another fudge factor of an incomplete order of magnitude, right? So let's say they actually managed to recoup $5 million in a year. So now that works out to be a net loss of $15 million a year for these particular officers. In a year where the TransLink itself says it has a $45 million shortfall on the horizon. I mean, does that make any sense to you, Ethan?
Well, I mean, it doesn't make sense in the terms of stopping fare evasion, but I mean, how do you put a price on preventing someone from getting, like, you know, pushed down a flight of stairs or pushed in front of the SkyTrain or, you know, robbed or raped or something like that, you know, when it's dark out and they're using the SkyTrain?
That is an excellent and very valid point. And I don't think I would have any huge issue with the whole transit cops in themselves if that's what they were doing. If they were patrolling to stop real crimes, then I'd say great. Because, I mean, I'm not saying there's no need for any kind of security on the mass transit system. I think there's a case to be made about what degree you have on it. But yes, there are crimes done. But how are they stopping someone being pushed down a flight of stairs when they're being distracted by checking to see whether you have an up-to-date fare pass or not? Mm-hmm. So again, I agree with you at one point, but I think you actually reinforce the point that I'm making, that it seems to be a bit of a misdirection of their efforts. Now, of course, we all noticed that in the lead-up to the Olympic Games, we had the green shirts, as I like to call them, appear at the SkyTrain stations, which were, of course, intended to help tourists navigate the system. We also noticed that with the assistance of transit cops, it seemed like actually their primary duty was to ensure that no one committed the immortal sin of hitching a free ride. In the infinite wisdom of our rulers, they've decided to add turnstiles or fare gates to all SkyTrain stations. The project, which is currently underway, will cost the fare payers and the taxpayers, because most of the money is actually coming from the provincial and federal governments, it will cost us about $171 million, not including upkeep. The gates are intended to be up and running about next year sometime, and are estimated to save/recoup TransLink about $7 million in, quote, lost fares. So let's just pause for an effect there. Maybe you missed that. So they're spending $171 million to save $7 million. Now, I'm not great at math, but that doesn't seem to be an effective use of money. So let's assume they get the return they're expected, but I mean, this is quite unlikely. There have been turnstiles in other countries like London and other cities, and usually the amount they expect to reduce in truancy ridership is actually about half of what they're actually expecting to get here. So you'd actually expect about 3.5. But let's be optimistic, and let's use $171 million cost and $7 million in reduced truancy. We can expect the system to pay for itself in 25 years. And that's assuming the system will not need to be replaced due to, you know, age before that date. This strikes me as a bit of a classic case of being penny wise but pound foolish. TransLink also claims it will make the station safer because, as we know, criminals are allergic to turnstiles. Okay, it may keep out some vagrants out of the stations. It's never quite been a problem when I ride, and I ride quite often, and I pay all the time. And perhaps it will prove to be impossible for the very drunk to actually navigate through a turnstile. I mean, you have seen on occasion the really drunk person on a bus or on a SkyTrain who, frankly, is annoying and glad if they couldn't quite make it on there, although having them walk the streets may not be the safest thing in the world, but that's a whole other issue. But for the other kind of criminals that we're talking about here, so like, you know, the drug dealers, which are a large presence in our city, or the petty criminals, you know, the thieves and all that, $2.50 for a fare is just a minor cost of doing business. Of course, the big foolish assumption is that the people who don't pay can pay but choose not to. It seems like our rulers totally assume that the people out there are morally evil, that they are just out to rip off the system, and they're doing it almost out of malicious intent. Well, the truth is, a notable number of the fare cheats are the homeless and the working poor, who literally cannot pay the fare, but often still need to use the transit system to get around. I mean, am I wrong?
Well, I would hazard a guess that's true. Has there been any studies or documentation to show that the majority of fare evaders are people who are lower income people who can't afford fare?
Yes.
Yes, good.
Anecdotal evidence.
Oh.
Well, actually, no. So I'm gonna actually flip that around. And because I will agree that from the evidence I have seen, and I've seen some people who've slipped on without, right? And almost all of them appear to me be at least homeless. Now, of course, you can't tell of the more affluent whether they have slipped on or not for SkyTrain. But the TransLink itself just refers to them as fare evaders. And they don't actually say, well, hey, this person, you know, could have afforded to but didn't. Because they don't, I mean, when they grab you to say, hey, you don't have a ticket, they don't sit there and ask for your social economic standpoint. And actually, again, anecdotal, so we have to bear this with an extreme grain of salt. The ones that seem to be pegged out the most are youth, students who don't look like they have, that look radical, you know, the ones with the weird hairdos or the skateboards. A lot of sort of like Chinese student types I've seen pulled over. Rarely do people like me seem to get pulled aside, right? They sort of kind of give me a bit of a pass and woohoo, great to be white in our society. Mm-hmm. But it appears that the people who are availing themselves to this free service are those who literally just can't afford it. I mean, most people, and this is one of those arguments where they have the tragedy of the commons, there is a lot of people who believe that people will always try and rip off the system if they can get away with it. But science, study after study shows that people have a strong sense of social responsibility. I mean, I know I do, that if I have the opportunity and I can afford to pay my social things, I will do it. Because I know in the end, it benefits me, and it's the right thing to do. And most people do believe in doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, along the lines of sort of the, you know, anecdotal experiences, there's been a couple times when I've been, you know, taking the bus somewhere, and I'll notice someone who visibly looks poor. They have the obvious cues up. And they'll get on the bus, and the bus driver will say, oh, hey, Frank, because, you know, they see these guys, and they say, oh, you know, come on, Frank, just get on the bus. You know, just sit down, it's okay. You can't do that on the SkyTrain, though. There's no driver to have a relationship with. So I wonder if there is a certain percentage. I mean, I assume the TransLink knows that happens. Like, they must know that happens a fair bit. But, you know, they can't. When they have turnstiles on and you know, the enforcement on the SkyTrain, it seems to me that the SkyTrain is not seen as the same kind of community service as the bus system is seen by. Like, I see the SkyTrain more as sort of like, it's like the first class of transit almost. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, see, that's one of the funny things. I almost see it in a reverse. Not so much that I don't think the SkyTrain seems classier than a bus, because it does in many ways, right? But one of the things I love about this city and moving to this city that just was the idea that I can go from one city to another on a mass transit rapidly and quickly. I mean, where I come from in Brandon, right? You can go from Brandon to roughly Winnipeg, but you got to have a car or a truck or you got to catch great. And it's a huge ordeal. But I can go from West Vancouver to Langley, all on public transit, relatively fast for things, and it somehow makes this large sprawling mass accessible to someone like me who doesn't want a car and probably couldn't afford one even if he did have one. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I find that mass transit, especially SkyTrain, because it is so quick, it does join up so many things so much more efficiently, is actually of more use to the less affluent because it allows them to so much more increase their radius. So if you're looking for a job, for example, and you're the working poor, you're not limited to just lower Vancouver or to Burnaby. You can literally get a job in Richmond, and it's a bit of a pain, but it expands your horizons to such a large degree. Now, of course, that being said, there is an issue that needs to be dealt with, but I don't think that this sort of fare grabbing is the most effective way to do it. As I had mentioned earlier, TransLink is expected to have a budget shortfall of about $45 million in 2013. A significant amount of that is to pay for increased services, notably a rapid bus service for Surrey, Langley, and Cloverdale, a bus along the Portman Bridge, which was just recently upgraded, I believe. And there was supposed to be an additional 600,000 hours of transit service across the Lower Mainland. And trust me, for someone like me, this increased service can sometimes mean the difference between getting to a job on time or being late. And if you're late too many times, you get fired. The number 10 bus, it is so horrific as far as the number of times it seems to be late. And then you get these sort of three buses in a row syndrome.
I mean, Vancouver's a growing city, and our transit needs are constantly expanding. I mean, there's been discussion for the past, like, 5 years about putting in another SkyTrain or rapid rail line going from, like, UBC out to Burnaby. So, I mean, there's lots of projects that are on the table, right?
Well, and let's not forget the Evergreen Line, which is supposed to hook up Coquitlam, which we don't think about. I mean, I think UBC has it just for the mass number of people, but UBC is well connected to the transit system. But as I say, this idea of shrinking the GVRD so that it's accessible to everyone, a line to Coquitlam adds a whole north... eastern part of the Lower Mainland open to people.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that brings us, you know, to say, well, let's remember why we have mass transit in the first place. The original idea, of course, is that a significant number of people, as I mentioned, can't afford to get around the city any other way. I mean, they can't afford a car. I mean, not only is it expensive to buy a car, but you have to license it, insure it, maintain it, not to mention the cost of gas. Mass transit provides a cost-effective way for the middle class and the working poor to have mobility and to get to their job. Of course, another reason that mass transit exists is its efficiency, which can be measured in at least three ways that I can think of. First, there are fewer cars on the road, meaning less traffic. For those who think traffic is bad now, imagine an additional 100,000 to 200,000 more people on the road in their own cars. And from the stats I read, SkyTrain alone has about 100,000 to 200,000, depending on, again, when the study was done, ridership every year. And that's not including the buses. Imagine if all those people had taken to the road. You think congestion is bad now. It's efficient also environmentally because, I mean, we have a hybrid system right now. Some of them are electric. Some of them are fossil-fueled buses. But even if they were all diesel-fueled, it produces a lot less pollutants, I mean, including things like CO2 and all that, which are emitted. There are fewer particles released in the air, which are, you know, irritants to people who have allergy or asthma. There's less smog, and it's just easier to breathe with less cars on the road producing less pollution. It's also efficient for when we do sort of wise up as a civilization and go completely carbon free, because it's going to be a lot easier to replace 1,000 buses than it's going to be to replace 1 million cars. Now, TransLink does need funding. We could jail people attempting to sneak in a ride, but ultimately, as we've already discussed, that costs more than it seems to gain. We could raise fares. However, that would only sort of serve to lower the ridership, thus lowering the revenues, and you start this sort of downward spiral that eventually allow the system to sort of wither away. Now, there have been some wise suggestions, though. There could be a relatively small levy applied to every vehicle sold in the GVRD. This alone could raise upward of $30 million a year. A minor increase in property taxes, about 1% to 3%, would be enough to fund the system. For a property, just to give you an example how much that would cost you, for a property worth about $80,000, that would be only about $50 a year. And if your house is worth half that, $25 a year. There could also be a small surcharge on gasoline, which would not only help TransLink budget, but also encourage more ridership and also reduce our CO2 footprint. As little as a 2% increase on the gas taxes would only cost people about $2 a tax, $2 to a tank fill, but would cover, like I say, the increase that they need to improve the service. I guess ultimately my point is it's a little petty, I admit, but I hate feeling like a potential criminal every time I take SkyTrain. Of all the great injustices that occur in our great city, fare jumpers do not seem to warrant a dedicated security force. It does not warrant implementing a police state. What it does is sort of distract us from what I think is a real issue regarding public transit, that it needs to be expanded, access needs to be increased, and it needs to have adequate and reliable funding provided by society. Vilifying the ridership over pennies missed that will not garner the real money needed by the system to keep it going, the money it deserves.
Well, you know, Don, if you're tired of feeling like a criminal every time you take the SkyTrain, then you just have to back Sam Harris about racial profiling, and then you can fly everywhere.
Well, as I say, I sometimes think I get a free ride, no pun intended, or maybe I guess I did mean that.
Well, depends on if you are getting a free ride or not.
Yeah. But I mean, it's like the sort of presumption of guilt we have, right? I mean, you know, we become so much more of a security nation, so much more of let's assume people are guilty, like Sam Harris, beforehand, mm-hmm. and that will somehow save society, even though when almost every empirical evidence sort of shows the reverse of that. And it makes life in the city, I mean, it's one of the great distractors. I don't like taking SkyTrain now whenever I see the cops out there. I should not be afraid of the cops. They are there to make life safer for all of us. But by having them do this extra role of being sort of instant judge and jury enforcer of petty little things, they can't really do their duty. I mean, how eager am I going to be to run to a cop saying, hey, I think that person over there looks suspicious, when the first thought in my mind is going to be, oh, I better check his fare ticket and that's okay, as opposed to, well, maybe this person really is dangerous and I should be looking after him. It puts them in the wrong moral space for them to really effectively do their job.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it also is a good lesson on how these conversations happen in the public sphere. I mean, the discussion over having like a property tax levy to pay for transit expansion. And the conversation typically goes, well, why should I pay for the transit expansion? It's like, okay, do you want to pay for $171 million of turnstiles put into the transit? Well, no. Well, then take the levy, you dummy. I mean, like, there's really very little skeptical scrutiny or critical inquiry into any of these questions that happens in any kind of public dialogue about this. And it's a real shame because, you know, investing in transportation, it's always a good investment.
And there have been actually quite a number of studies have bared that out, that mm-hmm. the greater the infrastructure is for public transit, the more affordable and accessible it is to people, the better it is for the city, not only in quality of life, but also in economic returns. Because again, let's talk about that property owner. I mean, how much is your value of your property going to be when your street next to you gets widened to three lanes to accommodate traffic that's going to include gas guzzling, belching sort of cars? How much more is your property value going to increase when you have a form of rapid transit nearby that makes your property accessible to the entire Lower Mainland? Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, there are so many more benefits to this than there are detriments.
Well, and also just pure bragging rights. I mean, Vancouverites love to brag about our city. And having a fast, reliable transit system is one of the best things to brag about. I mean, I was in London a couple of years ago, and people complained about the tube system. But honestly, it is a fast, efficient transit system. You know, the way that it's built serves that metropolis so well. And I've often thought that, you know, Vancouver's transit lines are very strangely laid out, whereas London has these like circles going outwards, and it's just fantastic. So, I mean, having a really good transit system that we invest our time and energy into, I mean, it is worth the cost because we get to say, ha ha, our city is so much better than yours. And that's so much fun.
Well, no, and it also goes to the thing too that because we have it, people tend to not think of it as a good thing. It's like, well, it's sure, I have SkyTrain. But I mean, it could be better. It does, you know, there is this stinky guy on the SkyTrain. Boy, it would be better if they didn't. You don't appreciate what it would be like if it wasn't there at all. And that, I think, is missed. It's kind of like people who sit there and they live at home and they say, oh, it's so horrible here. And then they move out and realize all the stuff that mom used to do for you. By the way, belated Happy Mother's Day. That mom used to do for you, or your parents used to, you know, they you had free cable. Well, you move out. Suddenly you got to pay for the cable and you realize, shit, this costs money.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so many times we don't appreciate what we have and we just tend to criticize it. And that's never a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, which is a lesson to appreciate us while we're on the air. But let's go to our skeptical highlights for this week.
I've got one this week. Vancouver Earth Run is coming up. Now, it's actually June 3rd, but people right now are beginning to sign up to do the run. They're getting their pledges out there. The Vancouver Earth Run, it focuses on oceans. All the proceeds go to a nonprofit organization that works towards better understanding and management of our marine resources. One of the things that they do is they go out and they help clean up beaches and that sort of thing. And as has been popular in the news, we've been actually getting a lot more garbage than we normally would because of the tsunami in Japan, which has finally made its way to our coast. Now, if you wanted to join in on the run, it's $25 registration fee for the 5K walk run or $35 for the 10K race. There'll be a link on our webpage how to get there. So, you know, let's be environmentally friendly. Take the SkyTrain down to Jericho Beach, which is where the run's going to be, and help save the marine environment.
Yeah, absolutely. My skeptical highlight is actually happening in the city of Seattle. It is the Tutankhamun, the Golden King, and the Great Pharaohs. This is, so they say, the last time the King Tut exhibit will be on display in North America. It's at the Pacific Science Center in Seattle, May 24th, 2012 to January 6th, 2013. So you have lots of time to go down and check it out. The exhibit features more than 100 objects from King Tut's tomb. They have artifacts from the ancient sites representing some of the most important rulers throughout 2,000 years of ancient Egyptian history. Tickets range from about $24 or $27, depending on when you go and if you're a senior or a student or whatever. But you'll find a link on our webpage to all that information. I really highly recommend it. I've seen bits and pieces of the King Tut exhibit over the years. It is really amazing and definitely worth seeing if you don't ever get the chance.
So, first of all, I agree. Really wonderful. Should go see. Seeing our long cultural heritage, I mean, it's Egyptian, but it's all of us. Mm-hmm. But I am going to call foul on that. I mean, what happens after this tour? Are they melting down all the works? This is your last chance to see it. They're destroying all the artifacts, so you better look at it while you can.
It's probably going back to the British Museum. They're going to lock it in a vault.
Yeah, one that's got a time delay for 5,000 years. So
yeah. Well, I don't know, honestly. I mean, I tried to figure out exactly where this exhibit will go. I don't know if it's going to honestly be the last time, but even if it's not, you probably are only going to get maybe one or two chances to see this kind of stuff in your life unless you go to Egypt. So I do recommend checking it out. It really is quite astounding.
I agree.
Yes. All right, then. Well, we're out of time here on the show. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on. Bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelation.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try.
If you wish to make an apple.
must first invent the universe. Space is filled with a network of wormholes. You might emerge somewhere else in space. Some went out in time.
The sky.